Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Tom Fox. I would like to welcome you to a special two-part podcast series that I did with Matt Galvin and Dan Kahn. Matt is well known as the outgoing chief compliance officer at ABM Bev and is incredibly innovative use of data, not only in compliance, but literally across the company to make the company run more efficiently and more profitably. Dan Kahn is known for his work at the Department of Justice, both as the head of the FCPA unit and the assistant head of the fraud section. We have a fascinating part series on how you should deal with the Department of Justice, both in the investigation phase, during the investigation, and post-resolution. Have you ever thought about the intersection of tax and compliance? Well, I had not until I did a five-part podcast series on Taxman with Tracy Howe on the Compliance Podcast Network. Dan Kahn and Matt Galvin, Part 1. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, back for another episode, and you are in for a real treat today because I'm in for a real treat today, and that's how I judge the quality of podcasts. We have Matt Galvin and Dan Kahn in a joint podcast. So, gentlemen, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to visit with me. And if I could start out, both of you have relatively recently had some moves in your professional career. Could you tell us what you're up to now? Dan, could we perhaps start with you?
Sure. Well, I recently, about 5 months ago, rejoined Davis Polk & Wardwell. So I'm a partner in the D.C. office. I'm doing white collar work. Before that, I was at DOJ, where I was the chief of the FCPA unit, the head of the fraud section, and the acting deputy assistant attorney general over the fraud section.
Matt, how about yourself?
So I spent 7 years at ABM Bev, and I'm actually winding down my period as the vice president of ethics and compliance at ABM Bev, and picking up a number of kind of opportunities. I'm working with a nonprofit to drive federated learning across compliance technology. I have a research fellowship at Harvard Business School, and I'm looking at a few other opportunities as well as I transition.
So Matt and Dan, I'd like to start with a general topic of do's and don'ts when dealing with the Department of Justice. And before you even get to the Department of Justice, a corporation, chief compliance officer, CEO, board, general counsel, have to make what I think is one of the most difficult decisions that you can make in the compliance realm, and that is whether or not to self-disclose. So Matt, could I start with you and ask, in your opinion, what are some of the factors that should go into a decision to self-disclose?
Well, it's funny. Like I used to, when I think about this question, I think about a lawyer I used to work with, and her view was, you do all the investigation, you do everything the right way, and then you decide whether you disclose or not, then you don't disclose. And I think a lot of companies are still in that position where it is a very difficult risk assessment. I know there's a lot of enticement and a lot, and DOJ has done a lot over the last few years to incentivize disclosure. But man, it's very difficult to move all the stakeholders in an organization at the conclusion of an investigation into a posture where you're going to disclose, rather than a posture that I'm going to do everything possible to correct the behavior, do root cause analysis, fix it going forward, do everything possible in the right way there, short of disclosure. And I think often what it comes down to is beyond that, it's really, are they going to find out anyway? And at the end of the day, that's really the deciding factor, I think, internally, to push you over the edge of whether you're going to disclose or not, you know, once you commit to doing the right thing, regardless.
Dan, if I could ask you to maybe pick it up there, once the corporation's made the decision to self-disclose, what would be the best way to self-disclose to the Department of Justice? And what information would you expect the DOJ would want, at least at the initial stage of self-disclosure?
Yeah. And again, Tom, thanks for having me. And let me just also, before I answer that, just say that, you know, I agree with Matt. And just one additional nuance is the more likely that DOJ already knows about it or is about to find out about it, the less likely you're going to get credit for voluntarily self-disclosing, because they're going to say that there is an imminent threat of disclosure, and so they wouldn't consider it voluntary. So I think there are a whole host of reasons why it is a very difficult decision, as Matt put it, and add to that that even if you walk away with a declination from DOJ at the end of the day, you have a years-long investigation potentially, you have an SEC resolution potentially, and now more likely that you'll have foreign authorities, potential civil resolutions or civil suits. So there are obviously a lot of things for companies to consider. Once a company makes the decision to go in and bring a case in, at that point, the important thing is once you decide to go in, you're all in. And so when you do decide to disclose to DOJ, the last thing you would ever want to do is have DOJ or SEC feeling like you hit the ball at all. My recommendation, again, obviously every case is different, but in the normal course, you'd be disclosing, within a day or two, shooting an email off to the SEC and the DOJ around the same time, asking for an opportunity to disclose. And if it's at a stage where you don't know all the facts yet, perfectly appropriate and fair to say to DOJ and SEC that we don't know all the facts yet, but we're putting a marker down to disclose. And if you do start disclosing, it's important to obviously disclose the information that you know to be the case at that point and sharing with DOJ what you know.
Matt, after you've made the self-disclosure to the Department of Justice, you, of course, internally have the obligation to remediate anything you may have found in terms of failure or violations of compliance programs. How, as a CCO, do you think through ongoing remediation while you are continuing investigation after you've self-disclosed?
Well, I think as a first principle, if someone's telling you to remediate something that you haven't remediated yet, you're kind of already in trouble. Like, you need to be thinking about it as you go forward, before you get in that posture. I think to approach remediation, the other side of that coin is root cause analysis and understanding very well what went wrong and what gave rise to the environment where the misconduct occurred, and then remediating, that. I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, we had a business operating in a highly regulated environment. It's the kind of environment where to go from a field of hops to a beer where someone would drink, you need somewhere in the ballpark in some states of like 224 licenses. There's any number of kind of low level government contact in that kind of life cycle of your product. There were a number of ways in that life cycle that the incentives of the market were such that it encouraged, bribery. It encouraged someone slowing you down, encouraged someone saying, I can make this a lot easier, just because what was being regulated and the point of the regulation didn't really do much and have much meaningful effect on the end product. And so we did a root cause analysis and found, in say certain instances, that if you were going to produce a product and ship it internally within a state, the tax revenue for that, say that government official would be benefited. And then if you were going to export it, they would make a lot less. One of the kind of root cause analysis that we're doing is, why are we getting held up on our exports? And we saw that. We saw that, okay, the differential in tax income for the person making the decision made a difference. And then we said, okay, what's driving that person? Well, what's driving that person was they had a monthly target on revenue, on tax revenue. And what we learned was, if we shifted our logistics plan so that at the end of the month, it was domestic sales of product that would actually help him hit his target or her hit her target, the official hit their target, they would smooth and let things go. Whereas they would probably seek some sort of, ultra vires payment if it was an export project, because that was outside of their incentive. They weren't going to get any sort of benefit from that, from their own tax revenue. To do that, they, saw that as a personal sacrifice. And so having the kind of design thinking philosophy, or having the empathy for the official, getting down to the root cause analysis, getting to a remediation plan that worked in kind of a multi-stakeholder way, I think was a really good example of kind of remediation that's different from how people normally think about it. It's not just a policy. It's not just consequence management and firing someone. It's not just kind of looking at it. It's what were the economic circumstances that drove the misconduct, and how do you fix your business and fit your business around it to operate in the most safely way possible? I think that to me is a kind of a critical way of thinking of remediation that I don't see a lot of when I talk to other companies.
Dan, if I could turn back to you during the, or rather after the self-disclosure, what ongoing communications would DOJ expect? Would there be a specific or particular cadence you would expect the information? Is it really not simply reporting, but an ongoing dialogue where you, or rather the department, might ask for specific points or additional information? How does that part of the process go?
So I think it's, as always, case by case, and there may be situations where what I'm about to say is doesn't make the most sense and isn't the right call. But I would say, as a general matter, you basically want to be having that type of a discussion with DOJ and with SEC to understand what they expect and what they're looking for. Because again, the last thing you want to do is end up in a situation where you think you're cooperating, and then down the road at the end of the investigation, you find out that DOJ or SEC has a very different view. And so ensuring that there is an open dialogue about that and understanding what their expectations are is one of the most crucial aspects of interacting with the department. And so it may very well look like having a regular call if you know DOJ or SEC are asking for it. Certainly you want to consider whether or not you are measuring expectations appropriately. If they want to have a weekly call and that weekly call is going to lead to no update 3 weeks in a row and they start to get frustrated with that, it's important to lay that out at the outset as to why you don't think having a weekly call, at least at this stage in the investigation, is necessarily productive, because you're still getting all of the documents in or you're still haven't had an opportunity to interview anyone. But, you know, making sure that you understand what DOJ and SEC are looking for, and then figuring out the best way to get them the information, whether it's, you know, a biweekly call, a monthly call, you know, periodically as you have updates to share, that is obviously the key.
I love it, Dan. It's like the puppy training philosophy to government management. You know, don't train a puppy without a treat. You know, make sure you have a treat or the puppy won't do what you want it to do. Sorry, Tom.
You know, I just got a puppy about a month ago, so that resonates with me.
Incentives, incentives, incentives. They drive a lot. We're going to have a quick message from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more from Matt Galvin and Dan Kahn. So, Matt, internally, how does the CCO report in an investigation? Do you, and would, I suppose it's going to depend on a case-by-case basis, but are you reporting to the general counsel? Is it a more collaborative approach? Is it reporting up to the board of directors or perhaps a special committee of the board, whether that be a standing committee such as audit or truly a special investigative committee? How does the internal reporting of a corporation work from the CCO perspective during an investigation?
Well, I mean, from a structural perspective, there's little more important than the kind of like thinking through these sorts of reporting lines before you need to. But at the same time, the more sophisticated the investigation, the more you have to make probably the two most difficult calls as a CCO is who's in the war party, who's running the investigation, and then what's the scope of the investigation. And that's why you get paid the big bucks as a CCO, or you hope to get paid the big bucks as a CCO, is because you're kind of in charge of those two critical decisions. And I think you have to be, there's no right answer to what you're saying, Tom, because I think it will depend on the size and scale of an investigation. But let's assume one of somewhat a decent amount of complexity. I would think that if you're only talking to the general counsel, you probably have a problem in terms of how you structured your investigation, if it's going to have an impact on your business. I was very fortunate that we had, you know, a compliance committee of five senior level people within the company. It was the CFO, the general counsel, the chief of corporate affairs, the chief people officer, and the chief strategy officer. They were the ones that would kind of get
the more detailed reports at the higher level of how the investigation would go. And then you have to be talking to the board. And most likely in most circumstances, you know, I think the most common structure is you have some sort of dotted line or relationship with the audit committee, and you're regularly keeping them informed. And I think that's probably the kind of best, you know, out of the box kind of reporting structure, some sort of compliance committee of senior management, some sort of regular update to the audit committee. And then I think what I see in the market now is an increased interest by external auditors in investigations, an increased level of detail and how they want to be reported to and what involvement they might want to have in the contour of the investigation. And I think there's, you know, there's certainly a lot of tension there around privilege, around role and responsibility and that. But I think that's something that I think the market's moving towards. Whether that's a good idea or not, it's kind of an open discussion for debate.
So, Dan, if I could take you back to a time when we actually had in-person meetings at the Department of Justice, I guess that would be called pre-pandemic. What should a company expect when they meet in person with the Department of Justice? One of your predecessors showed me the conference room where they would meet, and so I have some appreciation of actually what it looks like. But what happens in as you near the end of your investigative phase? How do you present to the Department of Justice going forward?
Yeah, and look, I don't think we should take for granted that that everything is going to return necessarily to all of these meetings will necessarily return to in person. I hope they do, and I think they eventually will. But I also think that the government as well as law firms have learned to do a lot virtually, and it's certainly a lot easier to schedule meetings virtually to not have to account for travel. But assuming that you are meeting in person and you're sitting across a conference room table from DOJ or SEC, you know, a lot of the end of investigation discussions is hopefully not all going to be new. Some of it will be new, but if you've done your job throughout the investigation, you're having regular communications with the SEC and the DOJ about the development of the facts, about the compliance program. And, you know, again, I think a mistake that can be made is to wait till the very end to start talking about compliance, because compliance is critical in terms of both what the resolution is going to end up looking like, what type of credit you get from DOJ, but also whether or not they think a monitor is appropriate. And so starting that conversation earlier is important. But once you get to that resolution phase, you're obviously arguing to DOJ and SEC all of the factors and all of the arguments that are most helpful to you. And you know, I think some of the companies that have, you know, not done as well in front of DOJ or SEC, certainly while I was there, were the ones that would come in and make every potential argument under the sun and not really focus in on the ones that had the most weight and were the most credible. And I think when companies did that, I think DOJ and SEC found that much more persuasive and felt like they could trust defense counsel and the company. And I would also say that especially when it comes to compliance, having the chief compliance officer there, having a compliance officer there who really is the expert on that information and really can, you know, explain it in the most persuasive way and the clearest way to DOJ and SEC and be able to answer all the questions that they have as they come up. That's really important, both because it gets DOJ and SEC the information that they're looking for, but also because I think it shows DOJ and SEC that there is this person at the company who really gets it, who's really committed to compliance. They are the face of the compliance program, and that in and of itself is very helpful.
What are some of the ways that DOJ would seek demonstration of compliance program effectiveness? Is it simply the data? Do you drill down to test one or two things? How does that discussion go?
So I certainly think that the data is important. You know, DOJ and SEC, they have when I was there, we had a list of things that we would ask for to you know, show how whether or not the compliance program is effective. Certainly one example of that is, asking for recent risk assessments that were done and what changes were done as a result of that. Another may be examples of hotline reports, not just the number and what they relate to, but, examples of how they were dealt with from beginning to end, including discipline. And so there's a number of areas, but I think that the point is, and a lot of this is laid out in the Evaluation of Corporate Compliance Program guidance that we put out back originally in 2019, and then an updated version in June of 2020. Those are the types of things that they'll ask for, and they will essentially want to see both data, but also examples.
Matt, if I could turn to you now, perhaps some post-resolution, and as an outsider looking at ABM Bev, looking at yourself and your complete compliance team, you were very open in talking to the compliance community about some of the innovations that you made, particularly around the use of data. And you didn't stop when you resolved your case. You continued to innovate and you continued to use data to not simply build out a compliance program, but at least from my perception, once again, as an outsider, seemed to me you were driving overall business efficiency at ABM Bev. And I was wondering if you could maybe give some thoughts on continuing the momentum and how you were able to start something with something to perhaps help get through an enforcement action, yet use data to build out something that became an incredibly powerful tool for ABM Bev.
No, and I think there's a couple different phases of that. When you go to the kind of life cycle of an investigation and that post-resolution period, whether you have a reporting period or a monitor, that's probably the greatest kind of moment of power and influence that a compliance officer could experience within the company. And then as that goes on, so I had the benefit of having that opportunity at the same time of a momentous acquisition of $100 billion acquisition, which also kind of created, opportunity and honestly budget to kind of do things. And that kind of gave me a moving start. A few years ago, our previous head of corporate affairs had this insight to say, well, we should also then take the momentum on all the technology you're developing from that and pivot and have kind of the compliance ethics function be more of an external reputation driver. And that was, quite honestly, Tom, strategic to do that. And it's funny, but I look back, I was opposed to that at the time. I'm like, no, compliance should be kind of like almost like corporate intelligence. We should be in the dark. No one really wants to know. Look at me. I'm not camera ready. I'm not external. We should be back room. And it was totally wrong. And it was great for the company to be more forward in that. And it was great for the company to take more of a leadership position in that front, because we were developing technology that not only I think was great for the field, really good for ABM Bev, but also readily applicable across companies. And it led to, I think, a lot of moments of inflection. One is, I think this paradigm of corruption as a single kind of bad actor, this rogue actor kind of theory, is very misleading, because it's never that. It's never a single bad person in a company and a single bad official or agent, right? It's about gray market dynamics that incentivize certain behavior because it's more efficient to get business done in that way in that moment of time. And yes, ethics and compliance is sometimes about doing things a bit harder. Sometimes it's about, if you diagnose and do a root cause of corruption itself, it's a collective problem. And so unilateral corporate solutions are not always the most efficient way to tackle this kind of collective economic problem of corruption. Collective action will be. And I think the more companies can work together and collaborate, the more you can kind of reduce inefficiency of companies cycling through compliance processes independently without benefit of another. The more you can break down those silos across kind of market actors, I think the more you can actually go at the root cause of corruption. And I think as the company's program evolved, the more we saw You know, if my job is to drive business efficiency and if my job is to defect a company, then my job is also to drive reputation. And it's also to incentivize collective action to get at these issues to make business work better generally.
This is Tom Fox again. That concludes part one of the special two-part podcast series with Matt Galvin and Dan Kahn. I hope you'll join us again next week for part two. I'm also thrilled to announce that the five-part podcast series, Trial of the Century, the Enron Trial, was specially honored by the Webbies, the top award in podcasting, as a special series. The series was done in conjunction with my good friend and colleague, Lauren Steffi, who covered the Enron trial for the Houston Chronicle. And we go through the trial of Enron. Check it out. I know you'll enjoy it. And thanks to the Webbies for the award. The FCPA Compliance Report is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.